You know, I was thinking as we were singing, Sonny, it's all one of the things about being a young person, going to retreats and so forth, is the fantastic singing that you have at such places when you have lots of young voices together. But I would question whether or not your singing was better than that, even at the youth retreat. Wouldn't you like for everybody in the Woodlands to have been here and been a part of that singing? Really encouraging. Thank you, Sonny, for all the effort and time that you put into it. I've got a handout sheet that I'm going to ask some fellows that are going to hand this out. Make sure that you get one. It will be an outline for not only tonight's lesson, but kind of serve as the first handout type outline for lessons upcoming on Sunday evenings. And while they're doing that, let me tell you a little story while they're getting that done. Maybe you heard about the young Marine and his commanding officer that were on a train headed through the mountains of Switzerland. And they could find no place to sit on the train when they got on except for two seats right across the aisle from a young woman and her grandmother. In fact, it was kind of a berth, and they were facing one another. And after a while, it became rather obvious that the young woman and the young soldier were kind of interested in each other because they were giving each other little looks that began to be noticeable. And not very long into the trip, the train passes into a tunnel, and it's pitch black. You can't see your hand in front of your face, and there's a sound of a kiss. It's followed by the sound of a smack, a slap. And when the train emerges from the tunnel, the four of them are sitting there and nobody says a word. The grandmother is thinking to herself, "It was really brash of that young soldier to kiss my granddaughter, but I'm glad she slapped him." The commanding officer is sitting there thinking, "I didn't think that boy had the nerve to kiss that girl, but I sure do wish she hadn't missed him and slapped me when she slapped at him." The young woman was sitting there thinking, "I'm glad the soldier kissed me, but I wish my grandmother had not slapped him." And the young Marine is sitting there with this satisfied smile on his face, and he thought to himself, "Life is good." When does a fellow have a chance to kiss a beautiful girl and slap his commanding officer all at the same time? We set the stage this morning, hopefully, for this study. I don't know how long it will go. If you're in my Thursday class, I don't want you making any rude comments. We started 2 years ago a survey of the Bible in our community Bible class on Thursday morning, and we're all the way to Deuteronomy right now, 2 years later. And so my survey has turned into something less than a survey. But we're enjoying it, and we're not on any time frame in that class, so we'll probably all die before we get through that survey class, but that'll be fine because we'll die studying, won't we? We're on a little bit more of a time frame on Sunday nights, not necessarily too rigid, but I'll try to keep this within a reasonable number, and I won't commit myself to say how many that is, but not too many. Okay? And I've given you something that I put together here that I thought might be beneficial to you for the future and kind of broken it down, and it'll provide also our outline for the night, and you're free, it's yours, so you can make notes on it if you would like to. In Genesis, the thing that we talked about this morning is to try to show, my goal will be to try to show how the Bible is just one continuous story. There are lots of ways to do that. We'll probably touch on several, but this is one. And this is an approach, by the way, that I use whenever I have a Bible study with someone who is very unfamiliar with the Bible. Is I will take the first time period that we have for our Bible study, and I will basically go over this outline. I don't hand it out to them because I want them to be looking at their Bibles. And what it does is give what I call a three-point outline, and this is not original with me. I just forgot where I got it, okay, a long, long time ago. And I've kind of tweaked it over the years and so forth to try to make it fit what I like to try to teach and how I teach. So you it's yours now, so you can forget where you got it and you can tweak it and use it for yourself. But I use it just to show people, because very, very few people, even people that grew up with a religious background, know that the Bible is just one continuous story, and that you can learn to tell that story without a tremendous amount of effort. Just a little effort on your part, and you can learn to tell the story of the Bible from the beginning to the end. And we talked about this morning that from Genesis through approximately 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles, and you know that 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles lay on top of one another. They tell the history of the exact same time period. And so when I say 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles, that's just two different stories about the same time period from a different perspective, much like Matthew and Mark are about the general same time frame and same things, just from a different standpoint and written for a different purpose. But this is a three-point outline that covers the whole Bible. And it begins in Genesis chapter 12 with three promises that God gave to Abraham. And you're welcome to turn there. Genesis chapter 12, verse 1 through 7, verse 1 through 4, if you want to cut it back some. But God appears to Abraham and he gives him three promises. And I'm going to break them up just a little bit. This is not the order in which he gave them, but I'm going to give them back to you chronologically. He told Abraham that he was going to make of his descendants a great nation of people, that he was going to give that nation a land, and then he said, through your seed, all nations of the earth will be blessed. That's three promises that will comprise a three-point outline that covers the whole Bible. That's what the Bible, that's an outline of your Bible right there. And the first one, he said, I'm going to make of your descendants a great nation of people. That will, if you would like to turn there, or you can read it on the handout that I gave you. Exodus chapter 1, verse 7 is a specific verse that you can go to show that God did, in fact, fulfill that promise. The Israelites were fruitful and multiplied greatly and became exceeding numerous so that the land was filled with them. And this was in Egypt. Now, if you go back and remember who was involved in that, you have the life story of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. And those are the four main characters from Genesis chapter 12. The book of Genesis ends with the death of Joseph. And so Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, their lives are all about God creating a great nation of people of Abraham's descendants. And that nation of people will be known as Israelites, children of Israel, Jews, Hebrews. Those are all synonymous terms. And so that's the first outline of it. And of course, we know there are lots of stories that fit into this. And once you learn this outline, you can go back and fill it in. And you'll fill it in with incidences, and you'll surprise yourself over a period of time once you get a few basic fundamental things, like Joseph dies at the end of Genesis. Moses will die at the end of Deuteronomy. And that's two really big pegs that you can draw. And know that everything and everybody from Joseph all the way through the end of the wilderness wandering is going to take place in Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and then be rehearsed in Deuteronomy. And so there are lots of history that's put into that. But somebody asked me one time, by the way, just really sincere young man that was serving as a youth minister for the congregation where we were. He came to me one time and he said, Ken, what's the difference between preaching and teaching? And I thought a minute and I said, well, when we preach, you don't get a chance to say anything. So that's about the only difference between my preaching and my teaching. It's kind of the same. And you'll probably notice that, except you don't get a chance to talk. Or at least I hope that you don't. Anyway, promise number two begins in Exodus chapter 1, and it ends in Joshua chapter 21, or essentially the end of the book of Joshua. And you can go back. Another way to tie the Bible together is to think about the meanings of the names of the books of the Bible. Genesis means beginning. Exodus means the coming out, so that tells a story of them coming out of Exodus. Leviticus is named after Levi, the Levitical priest, and so you would expect to find information in there about priests and sacrifices and what kind of garments they wore and so forth. Numbers, you would expect to find something about numbers there, and that's what it is, a census of the people. Deuteronomy, the word means the law repeated or the second law, and that will take place whenever the children of Israel just make their last camp after the wilderness wandering of 40 years before they cross into the land, a period of about 90 days, Moses will address the people like a father would address his children, his last address, and he'll say to them, hey, don't be faithless like your fathers, but go in and conquer that land. God has given you that land. And when you get in there, here's how you're to act, and here's the laws, and he gives additional laws to the Ten Commandment laws. And he'll say, here's how you're to divide the land up. And whenever you get over there, you're going to have this little ceremony that's going to be called blessings and cursings, and you're going to go through that. And he's going to give them instructions and repeat the law for them, repeat their history, and give them a last admonition before they go in. And so from Exodus chapter 1 through Joshua is the story of God giving that people that he's now formed a great nation of Abraham's descendants by the time that they're in Egypt. In Exodus chapter 1, and now he's ready to take that nation and give them the land that he promised. And by the way, if you follow Abraham, Abraham traveled through that land. He traveled around the Fertile Crescent, and he came through that land of Canaan, and God told him, this land that you're where your feet are right now, I'm going to give to your descendants. I'm not going to give it to them right now because the cup of iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. In other words, the inhabitants of this land have not yet reached a point where there is nothing within their society that would point a person toward God and serving God. But they will reach that point. And in about 400 years from the time that they go into servitude, I'm going to bring your descendants back here and I'm going to give them that land. And of course, we know about Abraham, that he buried his wife there. We know about Joseph, that whenever he died, he made his sons promise that they were going to bring his embalmed body out of Egypt and bury it in that promised land. And so all of these people looked for that land. They looked toward that land. They lived with the confidence that God was going to do what he promised. And see, so he said, to your offspring, I'll give this land. And you can go to Joshua 21, 43 through 45, and find that God did, in fact, give them that land. And that is a bone of contention today among some premillennialists who say that God never has fulfilled the promise he gave to the Jews to give them that land. He did fulfill the promise. Joshua 21, 43 through 45. So the Lord gave Israel all the land that he had sworn to give to their forefathers, and they took possession of it and settled there. The Lord gave them rest on every side, just as he had sworn to their forefathers. Not one of their enemies withstood them. The Lord handed all their enemies over to them. Not one of all the Lord's good promises to the house of Israel failed. Every one was fulfilled. They got the land, folks. They got the land. And God made provision for them to keep the land. They didn't keep those provisions that he made for them to keep the land, and so consequently they lost the land. But God fulfilled this promise through the lives of primarily Moses and Joshua. And, of course, they have contemporaries like Aaron and Miriam and so forth. And you can fit those stories into that. And God now has made a great nation of Abraham's descendants. He's now given them a land, the land of Canaan, the promised land, the land that flows with milk and honey. He has given them that land. They've settled in it. They possess it. They own it. It's theirs. And there's only one promise now that remains for God to fulfill. From this time, from here on, now I realize that the first two promises were fulfilled in a relatively short period of time. Relatively short in terms of how much of your Bible is comprised, is used to fulfill those. And then there's a lot of your Bible left. And the rest of what is left is the fulfillment of one more promise that God gave to Abraham. And that promise was, through your seed, I will bless all nations of the earth. And we don't know who that seed is for sure. In fact, we probably would be very much like the Jews who assumed from that time on that when he said, through your seed, I'm going to bless all nations of the earth, that he was talking about the nation of the Jews. The Jews believed that. And some Orthodox Jews would still believe that to be the case today. But when we get to the New Testament, Paul corrects that misunderstanding. Now, I can see why they would have thought that, because the term seed is most often used of the descendants of someone. But when we get to Galatians, Paul will write to the Galatian Christians in Galatians chapter 3, verse 16, and he'll clarify that misunderstanding. He said, when God spoke to Abraham and he said, through your seed, I will bless all nations of the earth, he did not say seeds, meaning many people, but unto thy seed, which is Christ. And I'd like to make a little aside point right here, too. The Bible, when it was given, was inspired. It was really inspired, down to a letter. You understand what I'm saying? His argument here is based on one single letter in the Hebrew alphabet. The difference between plural and singular of seed. He said he did not say seeds, meaning many people, but he said seed, meaning one man. And that man, Paul will say, is Christ. It is through Abraham's seed, Jesus Christ. And that's why the genealogical records were so very important, all the way down to Jesus' lifetime. And by the way, in AD 70, those genealogical records were destroyed, and there's not a person in the world that can prove he's a Jew today. Not a person alive. Those records were burned. But it was absolutely necessary that they be kept, because God had given a promise to Abraham that it was going to be through his lineage. It was going to be one of his great, 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 and you can keep on with the greats, grandsons, that was going to be the catalyst who was going to bless all nations of the earth. Are all nations of the earth still being blessed through Jesus Christ today? Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed, they are. In a way that they certainly could not have known. And while these first two promises, and we're talking about a three-point outline, while I would say, and I put a little note in here, that a really serious student could very possibly, probably follow, continue to follow the fulfillment of this promise through the lives of particular individuals, that would be rather difficult. You can do it through the genealogical records if you choose to do that, and what we have revealed in the Bible. But from this point on, it basically breaks itself, the Bible will break itself into time periods. There will be certain individuals that we will recognize in each of those time periods. But the fulfillment of this promise is more complex, because now it's going to involve a vast number of people and a long period of time. But the fulfillment of it is not difficult to understand. It just took a long time for this third promise to be fulfilled. And if you would, excuse me, we will in the future, we won't do it tonight, but we'll go to Daniel chapter 2. And Daniel had a dream about a series of world empires. And we'll look at those empires and we'll talk about a little bit about the impact that they had on the Jews, and that would be, the first one would not be Assyria, because by the time Daniel came on the scene, Assyria had already risen and fallen, and Babylonia was the world power. And so in his dream, Assyria won't be a part of it, but in biblical history, it is a part of it. And so you have Assyria, Babylonia, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. And it will be these world empires will all have an influence, a really strong influence, because the Jews will come under the rule of these world powers. And there will be some things that will happen and prophecies that will be made. In fact, the vast majority of the prophecies in the prophets in the Old Testament will have to do with these world empires and their coming or their demise. And I'll hand a little chart out to you, Lord willing, so that you can be able to put each one of the prophets in a place and see what it is that they're prophesying about. And one of the interesting things is that when you see that, and I'll probably have you add a little bit to the chart and do a little work on the chart yourself, but if you'll keep that chart in your Bible, and I have one of those charts in each one of my Bibles, if you'll keep that chart and somebody asks you about the prophet Habakkuk, how many of you know what Habakkuk prophesied about? Raise your hand. Well, when you have the chart, we have one. And there are others of you I know that likely do also, but if you'd asked me on the spot, my mind would have gone blank also, so I wouldn't raise my hand for fear you might ask me and I'd have to try to prove it, like I said this morning. I'd like to be able to, for everybody to think I knew everything, but it's too easy to disprove, so I don't claim that. So with this chart, you'll be able to look at that chart, and about, I'm going to say at least 80% of the time, even if you've never read the prophet, you're going to be able to know what he's prophesying about. Now, how's that for a deal? Because there are clusters of prophets that prophesy just prior to the fall of a world empire and the rise of another one. And that, by and large, is what they're going to be prophesying about, because it's going to have an impact on Israel. And so we'll pick up and we'll look at those world empires. They have the specific character of, generally speaking, they were an oppressor to God's people. Assyria, that these world empires from the beginning until you start with Assyria and Babylonia, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome, they became more civilized as time went on. I don't mean that there were not war atrocities, but I'm saying the Assyrians were incredibly vicious, and the Babylonians weren't much better. The Assyrians delighted in torturing their victims. They loved to skin them alive. And when you went to, if you went to visit an Assyrian, a major Assyrian city, all these cities had walls around them. Well, the Assyrians built their walls with stakes, wooden stakes that pointed upward at about a 45-degree angle, so that they could cut the heads off of all their victims and stick the heads on those stakes all the way around their city walls. Now, if you wanted to besiege a city and you came up to an Assyrian city that had thousands of heads in various states of disrepair hanging on their walls, you better be serious about taking this city. You better not be half-hearted about it, or either you better go back home, because these people were serious foes, and you didn't want to mess with them. And whenever they took over a nation of people, they were incredibly vicious. And they loved to force march the people, and one of the prophets will talk about the Assyrians will grab the little children on their, we would call it a death march. They marched them to other countries, and they didn't care what kind of shape they arrived in, or very much if they arrived. And if the women with children slowed them down, then they grabbed the little babies by their heel and hit their head on a rock and dashed their brains out. And he'll talk about that. One of the prophets talks about it. And the women that are pregnant with child, they'll take a knife and rip them up and leave them laying there. They're vicious, vicious people. And God allowed, God sent that nation to overrun his people. Let that sink in. And then came Babylonia. And then came Medo-Persia. And Medo-Persia, for the first one, was the liberator. They were considered to be the liberators. In fact, there were cities that when the Medes and the Persians came and to besiege that city, then people from inside would throw the city gates open and welcome them in. And so they came in. Cyrus and Darius came in, many of the cities, as victors and liberators. And then the Greeks were in the Intertestament period. And we don't have anything per se about the Greeks, because when the Old Testament comes to an end, the Scriptures will be silent for a period of about 400 years, and the Greek Empire will rise and fall during that 400-year period of time. And shortly before the New Testament begins, the Roman Empire will become the world empire. And you know something about the Caesars. Well, those Caesars had a lot to do with first century Christianity. And one of the things that it's really interesting, and I can remember how shocking it was for me to find out that when Paul appealed to Caesar, he appealed to Nero. Of all of the Caesars that a Christian might not want to appeal to, Nero might be one of the top ones on that list. But early in his rule, he wasn't quite as bad as he was as it got later. But anyway, all of this history, and we'll bring some of this history, and we're not going to major on history, but we're going to talk about those world empires, and I'm going to give you something to help you understand that. Then, again, my goal is to show that this is one continuous story. The Lord had some things in mind before the world ever began. And it's really interesting to read in Revelation 3 that the Lamb was slain from the foundation of the earth. That's a really sobering thought. And it brings some questions to our minds. That if God knew that this His Son was going to hang on the cross, then why didn't God and you fill in the blank? We've all had some of those questions, haven't we? But God's hand has been in history. God has directed the course of history throughout time. Have there been some atrocities? Are there many things that happen in this world that God doesn't approve of? Certainly there are. Certainly there are. And God allows nations, if they are bent on a path to destruction, God allows those nations to continue on that path. He will put things in your path to try to stop it. But if you continue going around those things and ignoring those things and doing what you want to do in spite of those things, and they'll reach a point where God will say, okay, have your own way. And that's been the history of nations. There's never been a nation yet that hasn't fallen. There's only going to be one. When the world comes to an end, there will only have been one world empire that will not have fallen. You know what it is? Don't you? The church. The church. He said in Daniel, it will not be destroyed and it will not be left to another people. Nobody's going to come in and have the gleanings from it. Nobody's going to have the spoils of war from having overcome the church. The Lord's church will stand victorious to the end. And when we think about God working in the world, and we'll become more and more convinced, hopefully, as we study this and realize it and come to be able to talk about it and understand it and share this with others, then I want you to also realize that God's working in your life. Not only is He working among the nations, not only does God set up kings and brings down kings, but God's also working in your life. And He gives you blessings, and He gives you privileges, and He gives you opportunities, and He gives you abilities and opportunities to use those. And He gives us encouragement to use those abilities. Need I say that God expects us to use those abilities and opportunities that He gives us? And whenever we get our nest feathered so well and we're so comfortable that we won't be put out of our comfort zone in any way, we're really on dangerous territory. Because God's working in your life. And He gives us opportunities to come to Him. And whenever we stray, like the prodigal son, and the Lord is kind and gracious and long-suffering, and He gives us opportunities and encouragement to come to Him. Don't ignore them when God gives you that opportunity in your life. If you have a need tonight that can be met with a public response, either you're not a Christian or there's something in your life that you know is amiss, and you want brothers and sisters to be praying for you to help you overcome that, then this is your night while we stand and sing, won't you?